Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number as Mondays. That's Monday with Sandy. Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we got to get into, you know, what we always get into, and that's, you know, sometimes I think maybe people are saying that's all they ever talk about.
Ooh, what are we? Where
you
are,
and I.
Where are we going here?
Well, I'm saying about what's happening with Ukraine and all of those things. But you know what? You got to talk about that, man. That's what's more important right now in the world, and then that subject. And I know people might think and say, and I think people minimize because we're doing our own lives in this country.
Yeah,
that we don't see the big picture with what this thing could, and it could spin out of control at any given point, right?
Well, in fact, you know, I've sort of changed my vantage point on this. I used to think that presidents would retreat to domestic affairs when they didn't want to talk. Would retreat to international affairs when they didn't want to talk about thorny domestic affairs issues, and that was keeping us from solving our domestic problems. But I think, actually, now just the opposite. I think that domestic affairs are obviously, we've got to solve our domestic problems, and we've got to do it with a self-evaluation process, like I was talking about before the break. But the problem with our international affairs is that for a long time after World War II, we talked about it as it had to be bipartisan. Bipartisan meaning that we didn't discuss it.
Right.
We just agreed with whoever it was, the Secretary of State, the CIA, the President in the White House, as he was counseled by these ongoing institutions. We would just agree to whatever we decided. And it turns out that the foreign affairs that we adopt as a country are terribly important to us because, number one, it drives our defense budget, which eats up a great deal of our treasure. Two, it puts us in a position around the world of using not only our treasure but our young people in the military.
Right.
It's put us in terrible positions in terms of military involvements we've had over the last 75 years. And so we should talk about it, and we need to talk about it, and we needed to talk about it for the first 22 years of this century more than we did, because I think we've backed ourselves into some terrible positions, and I think we probably have helped create the foment that is now culminating in the Ukrainian war.
You know, there's no question that we need to talk about the foment that has occurred, because here we are. And this is China's continuing threats to use force against Taiwan will only increase support from the United States and others. And then you've got, you know, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, the congressional delegation led by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina triggered vocal outcry before and after they met Taiwan's leaders, including President Tsai Ing-wen and her foreign and defense ministers, in the hours before the Caudill landed in Taipei on Thursday, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian warned the U.S. was going down a dangerous path by endorsing Xi's government, which rejects the Chinese position that Taiwan ought to be ruled from Beijing. Well, why would Lindsey Graham then, before we even get a chance, he unilaterally screams that basically that we need to be preparing?
Well, ever since the recognition of China, which was carried out in Kissinger and Nixon period, we've walked a very fine tightrope about Taiwan, because Taiwan was historically a part of China. It only became a place that was separate from China when the Western nations decided to give Chiang Kai-shek, who was a kind of a horrible guy in himself, but he was the leader of the Chinese nationalists. They lost the revolution to the communists and Mao Zedong, and so we ended up providing safe haven to him in Taiwan by agreeing that for Formosa or Taipei or whatever we choose to call this island, We chose to protect it, but we've chosen also not to recognize it as an independent nation. We've chosen not to have it be part of the Olympics. We've chosen not to do all of the things that China has basically insisted we not do, and which Kissinger agreed we would not do at the time that we recognized China, which was basically that we would not distinguish Taiwan as a country separate from China. And here we are now, based on Ukraine, deciding that we want to go all the way to the brink, I guess, to protect Taiwan in a manner that is not consistent with what we've done in the past, primarily, I guess, because Taiwan now makes all these semiconductors, or I don't know what the reason is. Maybe it's just an exuberance we have about the American society and the requirement that we defend around the world those whose enemies are our enemies. And for that matter, if China is our enemy, have we had a national debate that has resolved why they're our enemy and whether they should be?
Well, but this is not the time for that. I mean,
well,
I think
it is the time for us to discuss at a national level how do we define our enemies and what is the national interest that we use to define who it is that we're going to oppose and why.
So no, I don't mean for us not to have the discussion.
Yeah.
I mean to be having the discussion right now with Taiwan and China. A national discussion I could see, but especially dealing with what we are dealing with right now with Ukraine.
Well, except, you know, we have this view that the dominoes, right? So Ukraine is a domino, and when it falls, Taiwan is the next contested space between us and a hostile country, hostile to us. So the view is that China might be emboldened, depending on what happens in Ukraine, to move on Taiwan. But Taiwan has been sitting there as an issue, and probably the only reason that China would feel compelled to move on Taiwan is if they think that we are going to do something to change the status quo from something that is, as far as they're concerned, seems to be adequate. And I'm sure that they are working on evolving in the direction of having Taiwan be assimilated into China. And I think the United States has been operating under the quiet pretense that
we're going to defend Taiwan.
No. I think the United States has been operating on the quiet pretense that it will get absorbed by China if it just needs to happen on somebody else's watch, because it's kind of a complicated issue to absorb, but that's what's going to happen.
Let's do this. Who do we have on the line, Sam?
CJ's calling in from Stoughton.
Ah.
All right, CJ, what's going on, man?
Howdy, gentlemen. I know you love my calls. You know, as I listen to Sandy, a self-evaluation is coming in November, and it's going to be a tidal wave, because I don't blame you for wanting to change the subject. And, you know, your party preaches, you know, tolerance, and they prove they're the least intolerant.
Well, what's his party?
Agree with them.
What's his party?
Which part?
Well, no, what is Sandy's party?
Well, I assume that he's a Democrat.
Well, why do you assume that? I'm an independent, actually. I vote differently at different times.
Can I ask you, did you vote for Joe Biden?
That was a low bar.
Well, the option was Donald Trump.
Let me ask you a question, CJ, which is not what Americans ask one another, but you asked me, so I'll ask you, did you vote for Donald Trump?
Hell yes.
Okay, well.
You know why? Because Afghanistan, after watching that.
We talked about this last year, man.
Well, wait. You voted for Trump after Afghanistan fell, because that was not the sequence of events.
No, I'm talking about Afghanistan never would have happened. Never would have happened.
Oh, so that's why you voted for Trump. Okay.
Hey, man, why are you talking about Afghanistan, man? Hey, let me ask you something. Why are you talking about Afghanistan?
Do you know what happened to Russia when they evacuated Afghanistan?
No, I didn't bring Afghanistan up.
I'd rather talk about how your party runs by polls.
I'm not a Democrat.
A crime bill.
I'm not a member.
A great crime bill.
Hey, CJ, I'm not a member of any party.
CJ, let me ask you this. You get very, very angry about the Democratic Party. Why does a partisan difference make you angry? Don't you think that's reflective of what's wrong with society right now? Is that you've called us, and you've called us for the purpose of expressing anger on the phone about having a discussion relating to differences in policies. And isn't that what's wrong with America right now? Don't you want to cure that? Don't you want to get us back to...
I want our laws enforced, Sandy. I want our laws enforced.
Which laws?
Oh, okay. As we watch crime, as we watch prosecutors continually allow recurring criminals back on the street. That's your party, not mine.
Okay, well, I think CJ, when you call, it would be better. I mean, if you want to be entertaining, you can be angry, but if we want to get angry.
I'm motivated. I'm motivated, Sandy. I'm not angry.
Well, you could be mistaken for angry.
Let me say this.
You're doing a good imitation of angry.
Okay. Well, you can be calm about it, Sandy, but the border is a disaster. Afghanistan was a disaster. Russia's a disaster. Inflation's a disaster.
Hey, do me a favor. CJ, hang on a second, man. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
I want to hang on a second.
Just have some ketchup.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us the same number as Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And so, CJ, let me say this to you, man. I don't know any other talk show hosts, and I've listened to plenty over 40 years, would allow a caller to call in and not be on the subject that they're talking about. And then to repeat the same thing that you do every time. The same stuff, man. It would be nice if you had an opinion on what we're talking about with Taiwan and China. But you come back with the same subject matter every day. Ben, you got anything new? Kind of stuff.
China never. Well, because you brought up Russia and Ukraine, and you know, China is watching, and Taiwan. They never got invaded when you know. I don't care if Donald Trump runs. That's 3 years from now. You know, I'm worried about right now in this country, and the mere fact that your party, you were earlier today, your first hour, you were talking social issues.
I'm not a member of a party.
CJ, let me just steer the conversation a minute here.
Talk about the crime bill then.
Let's talk for a minute about what we were talking about a little earlier. Have you worked for a corporation that used continual improvement, something like Six Sigma or Deming, and a Deming analysis of continual improvement? Have you worked at a company that's evaluated itself to figure out what it's good at and what it needs to get better at and what best practices might be for whatever they make? Have you done that? No. Are you familiar with it?
I don't need that. Go to the grocery store.
No, I'm not. CJ, just.
You let, guys.
Gosh, CJ, I'm just trying to have a conversation with you, buddy. You know.
No, you aren't. You're trying to deflect. I don't care about studies. I go to the grocery store. I go to the gas station.
Yeah.
I see people. You know, you can bring up all this analysis, and it doesn't matter to people.
Facts don't matter.
We see what's going on. We feel it in our pocketbook. you know, the claim that I'm being called a racist is
who called you a racist?
By, well,
you didn't get called that by
Sandy. That the deflection of what's coming in November is because what's been driven by the Democrat. Maybe you're not a Democrat, but we found out during shutdown there's 3 million women that still have not returned to work. So they can claim low unemployment, but everybody feels that when they go everywhere today, the store, the gas station, and who caused this? Who caused this? Who's in control right now? That's the point. It's not about Donald Trump. I don't care about Donald Trump.
Okay.
But I do care about President Biden and his failures right now.
Hey, CJ,
and I don't
think you do. Hey, CJ, man, thank you very much for the call. You know, we tried, right? But what is the issue is that CJ represents an awful lot of people like him, Sandy, who's upset.
Well, I think we were talking earlier about how it is that people feel financially insecure in this country in a time of prosperity. And my view is probably that CJ's, the tension in his voice and his excitement is the result of the fact that he feels financially insecure in a time of prosperity. And he ought to ask himself, and America ought to ask himself, why is that happening? And is he pointing at all the wrong reasons? And I think he is.
Yeah.
If he's feeling financially insecure, it's probably because he has trouble worrying about getting health care unless he's qualified for Medicare, which is a government program that he probably would have voted against if it was being offered, you know, voted upon as being a program to be offered to the public. We need to deal with this level of social insecurity because it's what's driving people in the direction to move against one another. For him to identify 3 million women who are apparently the cause of social problems in this country because they've decided not to come back to work. Now, I don't know what was the dog whistle story that he was essentially enunciating there, but I think there was one.
But he also hasn't taken it upon himself to read things for himself. It's clearly he's listening to the Tucker Carlsons and others of the world and conservative talk radio. And so he doesn't have to do any thinking. They'll do it for him.
Well, but I would prefer that we figure out a way to get a dialogue going that brings the CJs and others. Into a process where we could actually talk about it. But people who feel that way, fear drives people into a corner. Corner dogs bite.
Yeah, well, his emotions, you know, won't allow him to have a conversation that we can have because he can't listen to anything. He just is going to get his out.
Yeah, and, you know, what we were talking about for the last 2 hours had nothing to do with being supportive or negative to Donald Trump. We're talking about general issues in this country that need to be addressed, hopefully to make this place a better place.
Well, and the fact that this article that I was talking about with China and at the time that, you know, we're dealing with issues with Ukraine, to think that maybe we got to keep an eye on what's happening with China and Taiwan. I mean, there's no question China is watching.
Yeah, well, they're sure, and
as you would expect them to.
Yeah, you know, and so Americans look at this. Some Americans look at this one way, which is that whatever happens to Ukraine is likely to happen to Taiwan, and we better get prepared for it. So if we have to go to war or essentially fight a proxy war to defend Ukraine, then we're going to have to do that for Taiwan. So you could look at those dominoes two different ways. You could say, one, it's the foreign country that is the domino that's tipping is Taiwan or Ukraine, or is the domino our American policy that we've decided to invest ourselves in Ukraine, and so now we're going to have to invest ourselves in Taiwan. And that's a different kind of domino, but it's essentially dictating our policy in two totally different circumstances that require differential thinking.
So, Sandy, that's at the root and the basis of what I'm talking about with this, we've already, you know, and we're watching that in Ukraine. And then the American people, not the folk who are calling the shots, but the American people are seeing this. And you're saying, well, you know, Taiwan, we would definitely have to get engaged with because they've got all the semiconductors and all those kinds of things. They've got something at least we need that we would, you know.
Well, but China makes it. The semiconductors that aren't made in Taiwan are made in China. So, I mean, we're pregnant with dependence upon China for all kinds of electronics. And the fact that a bunch of electronics are made in Taiwan are just an accident. And, you know, if what we're saying is that we need to back democratic governments or the rights of people, then why aren't we talking about the Tigrans and Ethiopia, or why aren't we talking about Yemen, or why aren't we talking about all these countries that are currently in terrible condition based on warfare and problems with respect to human rights? And so that's all part of why we need to start discussing openly how do we decide what we're interested in the world. And who are our enemies and who are our friends?
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. At 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, we're here. Ukraine. It is, we're coming to a point where the Russians are starting to make their mark. They're starting to gain more and more ground. And I was listening to Zelensky over the weekend, and especially this morning, and he's almost admitting that, listen, this thing is imbalanced. We can't deal with the power of Russia. You know, they're still asking for more munitions, but there's, I don't know how many people they said hold up in an old steel factory.
Yeah, that Mariupol.
Yep, that is going to be destroyed.
Azov Star Steel.
Yeah, and that's the only place they can go now. And the military is trapped. What do you think is going to happen there? You know, they're going to slaughter those people in that building. There's not going to be any compassion. And I wonder if that may be what is going to tip the outcry that's going to be, Sandy, when those people are slaughtered in that steel factory.
Well, I think, you know, apparently the Russians gave them an opportunity to surrender,
right,
and they decided, and they said, no, we're going to fight to the last man, so it's the Alamo. And, you know, war is just a horrible thing, and it's horrible to watch from the outside, and it's horrible to watch something like this unfold. You know, this is a proxy war, and you know we're supplying the Ukrainians with enough weaponry to stand up and fight
and be slaughtered.
But you know, in this case, we're going to stand. They stood up and fought for a long time, and now they're likely to be slaughtered. And so, you know, that part of the morality of a proxy war is supplying people with the wherewithal to defend themselves, but not to succeed. And so the fate I've been worried about for Ukraine was that we were going to give them what some people call Dutch courage. Maybe Dutch courage comes in a bottle. I can't remember. But the Dutch courage to stand up and fight, but not to win. And so what we're doing really is allowing them to twist and turn in the wind and to suffer a substantial number of casualties and to have a great deal of destruction. and then ultimately to lose the war. Now, what happens after that? I mean, do they get occupied? Is there an indefinite insurgency? You know, the whole how it all plays out is very problematical and difficult to see. But none of it is good in terms of the outcome for the rest of the world as well. Because it, you know, if it goes through to a military victory for Russia, then we will have an indefinite period of sanctions and isolation and Cold War and essentially Iron Curtain type two. And so this is a very troublesome turn of events, and we can all look at it in the short term perspective of saying it Russia invaded Ukraine, so there's no question what the position of the rest of the world ought to be. But if we looked at it a much longer term, we'd understand that this is a horrible circumstance, and it should have been avoided in some fashion.
You know, Sandy, forgot what it was. I was reading the other day where it talked about the fact that America's thinking about now giving more offensive weaponry to Ukraine. And that's only going to escalate more Russia's response.
Well, in fact, there was a fellow, a spokesman for the Pentagon on this last week speaking on various networks, and he described how that they're always trying to carefully consider how far they can go down the road in terms of giving weapons to Ukraine without inciting Russia into taking extraordinary steps in a direction of escalation of the conflict. And so clearly, at least the Pentagon and probably the State Department and hopefully the White House are looking at this with that kind of careful lens to try and figure out what can we do without creating a material escalation that will endanger the rest of the world in some fashion. And however, that's one of the hallmarks of a proxy war. And it's one of the problems that is created by a proxy war, which is it leaves Ukraine as the pawn in this. And so we've got the people of Ukraine fighting this valiant fight.
That they can't win.
That they probably can't win without the escalation that the rest of the world is not going to be willing to offer them. And if we knew that in advance, then we should have adopted foreign policies that didn't embolden Ukraine into taking a position that excited what we've got.
You know, Sandy, there's the longer this goes on, the more I see that our nation is not going to get trapped into what, you know, Zelensky and others are asking for. You know, the other day he was talking about, you know, well, you're not going to send us troops. You just give us weapons, more and more weapons, more and more and more and more. Well, the United States is giving them weapons. The real issue is the weapons that they need to succeed are serious weaponry that will escalate and could especially lead to nuclear war.
Well, I mean, you know, nuclear war. You know, I'm not sure exactly whether that's the outcome. I mean, that is a potential outcome that is frightening, but there are lots of other outcomes that are
just as frightening. Not just as frightening, yeah, but, as nuclear war, but are pretty bad off.
Very difficult ones to deal with. You know, and Ukraine's a country of 44 million people, and maybe of those. You know, maybe there are some Russians speaking in the East that were not sympathetic to the Ukrainian government. So let's say we have 37 million stridently Ukrainian nationalists who are willing to fight. 37 million people with an army that's probably pretty sizable. If they had the aircraft that they need to have air cover, and you know that is a defensible proposition. But the problem is that we aren't going to provide them with all of that. I think they could defend themselves without troops on the ground, given the right kind of weaponry. But But we're not going to provide them with all of the weapons that they would need in that circumstance, I don't believe. And now the Russians have started to use what are called gravity bombs, which are essentially the kind of bombs we dropped out of the B-52s over Vietnam, which are sort of random destruction in major areas. And, you know, if Russia decides to go all the way in the direction of that sort of warfare, Katie, bar the door. You know, it's not, Ukraine's not going to be able to defend themselves against that. And there's a constant conversation ongoing in this war that's interesting to me, because it sounds like there are some implicit rules of engagement in the war. You know, Ukraine sends helicopters into Russia and bombards a couple of cities on the border, and Russia says, okay, now we're going to get you. You know, and so now, and or they sink, or Ukraine sinks the Moskva, this battleship, the cruiser, and then now Russia decides to send missiles into Kyiv. So they have the capacity to do these things, and they aren't doing them, but now they're doing them. So it appears that Russia has a fair amount of military capacity to use against Ukraine, which they are using, have used the discretion not to use in the past, which they are maybe going to use in the future.
So we've sent 11 helicopters. I don't know if they're talking about helicopter gunships. I don't know that we've sent to Ukraine, but that's only 11. And, you know, that's a drop in the bucket when you're fighting an army, you know, the size of what Russia has to offer.
Well, you know, I mean, Germany supposedly announced they were sending $1 billion worth of aid. I don't know if it was money or stuff. And so a bunch of the NATO nations are sending stuff as well. So I don't understand exactly whether Ukraine's getting a combination of money and stuff or mostly stuff. But, you know, but again, as I say, what concerns me about this is not the daily watch over battles and whether Ukraine is winning today or losing today. My concern is that in a proxy war of this nature, if we ultimately don't have and are not willing to give the Ukrainians what they ultimately will need against a war machine like Russia possesses, then why did we let Ukraine get into this position in the first place?
You know, Ukraine and Zelensky obviously knew that there's no way he could succeed in defeating Russia. He knew that going in, right? I mean,
well, supposedly we did. I mean, you know, there's at least been a public discussion about how the U.S. intelligence must have been off, because Biden and the U.S. government were basically warning the world that Russia would overrun Ukraine in a 3 or 4 day war. The government would topple. We apparently called Zelensky and offered him a flight out of Ukraine to give him safe harbor someplace. You know, so apparently we thought the Russians were going to overwhelm them.
Well, but they
quickly
probably could have overwhelmed them without the military aid and financial aid.
Yes, I mean, our military aid and financial aid and training and what have you obviously gave the Ukrainians the capacity to defend against what the Russians sent against them. The Russians might also have sent a weaker military. They might have used the discretion in the direction of a less violent assault on Ukraine in the beginning, which was easier to defend against.
Right.
You know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to know, because all of this does happen in the dark. But again, I simply repeat that a lesson to come out of this could be that not this lesson about what's happened in the last 2 months, but what's happened over the last 8 years or 10 years, and how did we have the process in Eurasia get to the point where it's gotten, and was there some other course of conduct that would have been more successful for all involved, including us?
Got to go to break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.
Rock it up.
back to the Earl Ingram Show as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number as Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, here's a commentary that says, Putin can't take much more of this. What lies ahead, defeat or apocalypse? And I think that's a great question to ask. He's not going to accept defeat. It's safe to say, isn't it? You think it's pretty safe to say that Vladimir Putin won't accept defeat?
Well, I'm sure I don't think he'll accept a defeat. And I don't think a defeat
means apocalypse.
Per se is, you know, in terms of leaving Ukraine, evacuating the entire country with his tail tucked. I don't think that's a likely outcome, because I think militarily and geopolitically, I think they've got Mariupol apparently on the verge of collapse. The collapse of Mariupol creates the land corridor to Crimea. Crimea is a fait accompli that simply hasn't been recognized by Ukraine, but Ukraine, I can't believe, has the military capability of launching an offensive to move down into Ukraine, which is an isolated kind of an area, and take it back. So if Crimea is a fait accompli, then what it comes down to is the Donetsk and Luhansk area, which looks to me like Russia pretty much occupies it right now and has been fairly successful with the Russian-speaking separatists. So he started out, you know, he's vacillated, Putin has, saying what it is he wants. But I suspect, and now we've got Zelensky one day saying that, you know, maybe we'll compromise on the Donbas region and eastern Ukraine. And by compromise, that would necessarily mean giving up some land there and the claim to land in some fashion. And then maybe now with the Mariupol problem, he's saying, well, now we're going to terminate talks altogether. He wouldn't terminate talks unless he was hoping to get lots of munitions and to extend the proxy war. So my sense is that there will be talks, that the ultimate outcome for Putin will be that he will get a fair amount of what he wants out of the eastern Ukraine, and we'll end up with what we've been talking about before, which is a neutral Ukraine. I think the sticking point is going to be, how will that neutrality be protected? You know, who will the trustees in protection of the Ukraine's independence be? But I think all this talk is based on day-to-day battles. Russia's going to get something out of this. They've also gotten a bloody nose out of it, and the public opinion about Russia has obviously changed radically. But I think this notion that it's either apocalypse or failure those are two straw men that I don't think are going to happen.
So Mariupol and Crimea now makes it possible for them to just move whatever they need.
Yes, and the other thing, however, that it does to Ukraine is that it creates a landlocked country, because if they get a land corridor that goes all along the Black Sea down to Crimea, then Ukraine doesn't have.
They can't get any weaponry in, or
but Ukraine doesn't have any port.
Right.
Okay. So Mariupol was its port on the Black Sea, and if that goes in a land corridor, then Ukraine has been emasculated to some extent, if that's a politically correct term for a country that loses any ports or contact with water bodies.
So, how much longer can they hold out? I mean, their manpower certainly is without food and water, because they're suffering through all of this.
Well, I mean, I think it's miraculous so far how long they've held out,
and it's only 2 months.
And if their losses are really as low as they're saying they are, 2,500 or 3,000 lost, but You know, it all depends on how they're supplied. Yeah, you know, the other problem with the way it's setting up is that Russia's in control of a fair amount of the methods for bringing supplies, logistic support to the Ukrainian armies that would be located in the east of Ukraine to fight in the Donbas. So Russia is neighboring there right there. I mean, Rostov-on-Don and other cities are immediately adjacent to Russian cities are immediately adjacent to the Donbas region, and from there they can provide supplies to the troops in Russia in a manner that they weren't able to do when they were in Western Ukraine.
You know, I was reading an article where Zelensky was talking to the International Monetary Fund people already about rebuilding Ukraine. And I was kind of surprised. Why would he even be having that conversation now? You know, I mean, it's...
Well, I mean, it's a bit like...
I know it's got to happen, but...
It's a bit like the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve having to talk about how inflation is a temporary phenomena. Because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy if you don't. So I'm sure Zelensky is carrying out a process right now of demonstrating his optimism about how this is going to turn out to keep the populace and everyone else and the governments of the world believing that Ukraine needs to be defended because it has this potential longevity. And I think it does have a longevity with a settled solution. I mean, if he settles in the manner that I described, then Kyiv and the parts that were damaged in the Western Ukraine will need to get rebuilt.
Yeah, but I guess if I'm, you know, and I can't speak from the perspective of a man whose nation and all of that slaughter and destruction has taken place, what's in his mind, you know, clearly what's in his mind is, at some point in time, this is going to end.
Yeah,
and then what is our nation going to be? I mean, support.
I mean, I have not read anything that describes what kind of a GDP or what would be left of Ukraine in terms of its, because the Donbas is the industrial. For instance, we point out that in Mariupol, the military of Ukraine is holed up in what is apparently the biggest metallurgical plant in Europe, which is this Azov Star metallurgical plant that does...
I couldn't believe how huge this thing
is. It's very, very big. So it would be big in the United States, and it's very big.
Yeah.
So that, and there are industrial installations like that in the Donbas as well. The Donbas is sort of the Alsace-Lorraine, which was the industrial region between France and Germany that was so contested. Well, the Donbas is an industrial region between Russia and Ukraine that's contested. So,
you know, I was just thinking about looking at that plant and trying to envision how big and outdated, a plant. You know that, and that plant was still active.
Well, have you been to Gary, Indiana, and seen the old Gary Steelworks?
Well,
that's something. It was like kind of like that.
Yeah, it's been such a long time since. Is that plant still up?
Gary Steelworks?
Yeah,
I haven't been there for a
while. No, I was about to say. I thought they had.
I think that was torn.
Yeah. All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.